iPad loaded up with things to watch. Noise-cancelling earbuds are top of my wish list. The woman who follows the crowd will usually go no further than the crowd. The woman who walks alone is likely to find herself in places no one has ever been before. Albert Einstein. Seize the day. I have an itinerary of possible pre-researched activities listed for each day of the holiday, but if I get sidetracked, so much the better. I have long since lost the compulsion to tick off every well-known site in town and find much more joy in the small, unexpected corners and B-list minor museums. For example, reconstructed within Rome's sublime, but lesser visited, Museo Nazionale Romano, are the vivid blue sky and orange tree frescoes from Claudius's mother Livia's villa. Incredible. You will see what she saw. It is by studying little things that we attain the great art of having as little misery and as much happiness as possible. Samuel Johnson. Solo travel equals guilt-free travel. So let's say, quite theoretically you understand, that if you were in Rome and there was a long queue for St. Peter's Basilica, you could decide to give it a miss completely and instead follow your nose down the Via Tunisi to the huge underground Andrea Doria food market to track down the world's best porchetta. Add a bag of mini mozzarella balls, a warm panino, some tomatoes split by the sun, and a bunch of basil. Find a bench, settle yourself down, and devour a picnic fit for a queen. There should be not even a glimmer of guilt for the unseen treasures of St. Peter's. Absolutely none. Licking the tomato juice off your fingers is just as much a taste of real Italy as Michelangelo's Pietà. I like to seize the very first part of the day and go for an early walk before most people are up. If the loneliness bug is going to bite me, it does so in the evenings, so I might have a leisurely restaurant lunch, an early bite for supper, and retire to my hotel room to enjoy a glass of wine and a bubble bath, followed by a book or laptop movie, and to plan the day ahead. Or I will discover my favorite restaurant and keep returning night after night. It becomes my local. It's amazing how much friendlier restaurant staff are when they see that you've been back several times, especially if you ask for a recipe, and it's something you might be less able to do with a traveling companion, who would probably like to try different places. If you miss having someone to share the experience with, write down your impressions of the day in a notebook as you go along, or a journal at the end of the day. It doesn't have to be Shakespeare, or even whole sentences. It's just to capture your thoughts and feelings, and to rekindle them once you're home. You're sharing them with the book. By the same principle, I also take a tiny portable tin of watercolour paints to sketch a couple of scenes on postcard-sized paper, the view from my hotel window, perhaps. I find that just the process of drawing and painting makes me really look, and even my silly little daubs are a potent reminder of time and place. I also collect ticket stubs, a CD of local music, a pack of local playing cards, some of the region's cooking utensils, and a recipe book, the label from the local beer, business cards from shops and restaurants, and I record street sounds on my phone. These all make wonderful memories, and I usually make a collage to frame. I prefer this to updating Facebook every few days, and besides, I don't want the world to know I'm not at home. Of course, you never really travel alone. You are always surrounded by people. It's your choice whether to interact with them or not. Sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. How do you go about meeting people if you want to? There are so many ways. You can meet them on the plane, at a hostel, a class, through meetup.com, go on a tour, hang out in the hotel lounge or lobby, chat to the diners at the next table in a restaurant, or even easier, at a communal table. If you have the good fortune to find yourself in Paris, at the irrepressible Bouillon Chartier restaurant, you'll be seated at a table with others and guaranteed to strike up a conversation. Or at the blissful rooftop terrace of Rome's Hotel Campo di Fiori, where residents gather in the evening to watch the sun set behind the dome of St. Peter's, and the conversation flows along with the Prosecco. Or just stay at the same hotel or B&B for a week and you'll get chatting. You can travel alone without traveling alone by joining a holiday tour. These might be orientated around food and wine, art or history, and some are aimed at solo travelers. Alternatively, this is something I've never experienced firsthand, you might try a cruise. You either love them or hate them. Check online if there is an organisation of local greeters who are happy to share the love of their home city with tourists. Again, if you're in the same place for a few days, go to the same cafe or market stall and strike up a conversation with the stall holder or waitstaff. Think about doing an evening food tour. I did a fantastic tour in the Trastevere area of Rome. We visited a dozen food shops, restaurants and wine bars that I would never have found on my own, and it was fun to share perspectives of the city with fellow travellers. If you want something to do in the evening, read blogs, ask the locals, and keep an eye out for posters advertising events. Some of my favourite evenings came about through serendipitous posters. One was for a recording of internet storytelling event The Moth in a bar in New York. I made friends with people in the queue, an Aussie accent comes in handy sometimes, and had a great time. Another was a free classical concert in a Prague church. And while I'm not a huge sports fan at home, going to a game is a great way to soak up the local atmosphere and get chatting to the people next to you. Check in advance and find yourself rooting for the local basketball or football team, or even sumo wrestlers, as I did in Japan. I see my path, but I don't know where it leads. Not knowing where I am going is what inspires me to travel it. Rosalia di Castro. Most people are kind. Be open, curious, respectful, and enthusiastic towards the prevailing culture, and you will be rewarded. Use your travels as an opportunity to move towards something, not away from it. Surprising things can happen. After being dateless in Sydney for an age, I was asked on a date by Maurizio, my taxi driver, within 20 minutes of arriving in Rome. But that's a story for another time. I consider that people take too many photographs when they travel. Don't snap them as a substitute for really looking and taking in the scene. Make your eyes your camera shutter. Blink and store the image in your memory. Of course, carefully selected photos are still an important part of the trip. And here are a few tips I've picked up. Do your homework on how to operate your camera at home and experiment in your own neighbourhood. Take pictures of the people you meet. We're often so busy taking pictures of the view that we forget to snap the people who make the trip memorable. Take pictures of your feet or your shadow from a similar angle but in different locations, on cobbles, in the water, on grass. I love taking pictures of old windows, decorative doors and peeling paint. They look great as a series, with their beautiful, faded, muted tones. You might find that the same colours keep cropping up. Search them out in clothes, food and architecture. They will make a great composition for a collage when you get home. Work out what should and shouldn't be in the frame. Adopt a stylist's eye for crop and angle. Follow the rule of thirds, a basic guideline for composition. Get up early and stay up late. The best light is 1 hour after sunrise and 1 hour before sunset. Take your time. A snapshot doesn't have to be a snap, but it can still look spontaneous. The beauty of digital is that you can check everything and go back and correct it straight away. Edit ruthlessly as you go along before you download your photos. It makes for a stronger story, and you know you won't do it when you get home. Don't store your photos away. I print out the best ones as soon as I get back for my kitchen pinboard or for a collage. I'm not afraid of storms, for I'm learning to sail my ship. Louisa May Alcott. Coming home. For me, one of the most trying aspects of being by myself is never being met at the airport. As everyone around me is being hugged and kissed, it gets to me. So if you arrive at a reasonable hour, ask a friend to pick you up. I ask my friends to give me that as my birthday present. Mini breaks. If you are not in a position to afford an overseas holiday, Treat yourself to a weekend away, perhaps arranging it around a course or exhibition to give it purpose and meaning. And if a mini break isn't possible, be imaginative. Theme a day or an evening for yourself at home, with some appropriate entertainment and food. Try feasting on the excellent Danish TV series Borgen while dining on frikadella meatballs and pickled cucumber. Curiosity is, in great and generous minds, the first passion and the last. Samuel Johnson. Christmas Day. Four of the saddest words in the English language must be Christmas dinner for one. Sounds like an edible suicide note, doesn't it? There is no doubt that Christmas is one of the most challenging times of year to be alone. Suddenly, your independent, I'm fine by myself, thank you very much, flag that has been flying fiercely hangs a bit limp. Of course you can spend the day very happily with friends or relatives, if that's what you want to do, or have as an option. If not, try reframing the day. I've spent the last 7 Christmases alone. It's taken a while to find the formula that works for me, but finally I have cracked it. Post-divorce, the children spend the day with my ex and his extended family. I have none. That was confronting to begin with. Initially, kind friends scooped me up and jointed me into their family celebrations. It was very well meant, but made me feel even more isolated to witness someone else's happy family celebration while sitting on the waifs and strays table. All I wanted was what they had. It made me feel I had failed. Now I choose to be alone. It is only one day, and it's a day I plan carefully, creating my own traditions. I think of it as a concentrated holiday for me. In October, I put a note in my diary to start making Christmas cards. I try to send out a lot of early Christmas cards, or emails, to connect, but also increase my chances of receiving some. It's a lovely way to know that others are thinking of you, even if it took a prompt. I decorate the tree with the same decorations year after year. I have a weakness for pale pastel, vintage glass Christmas baubles, which I collect on eBay throughout the year. I play Christmas songs in the preceding weeks to get me in the mood. My favourites are Gaudete, A Spaceman Came Travelling, Stop the Cavalry, and The Coventry Carol. I buy presents for myself. Tiffany Diary, Cookbook, Badadas Bubble Bath, a magazine, maybe some personalised jewellery from Etsy. Wrap them up and put them under the tree. I have established a Christmas Day routine. I wake up early, meditate, then go for a swim. It's Sydney summer. If that's not possible for you, go for a walk, just something to connect with nature. Then I read a good book or magazine I've been saving up and nibble on my favourite foods. A couple of wafer-thin slices of Spanish jamón ibérico, some cheese, a white nectarine and a glass of champagne. Going to church isn't part of my routine, but it might be yours. I will have lined up a movie or TV series that I want to watch, and if we have organised it ahead of time, a Skype call to friends overseas. Whatever you do, don't look at Facebook. The endless procession of happy families is overwhelming. I have a candlelit bath, whatever time of day. I write in my journal too, planning the year ahead. Christmas Day is now a happy, peaceful, low-expectation mini-holiday. Enjoy your own bliss. There is something quite liberating about it. Indeed, some friends are quite jealous of my day, avoiding those family tensions that tend to rise unbidden to the surface at this time of year. It has taken me a while to get here, but I have Christmas Day sorted. Another good option is to spend the day volunteering with a charity that feeds the homeless and disadvantaged. Interestingly, these slots are often oversubscribed and you need to sign up early. New Year's Eve holds similar horrors for me. Enforced jollity is not my thing. My advice is to devise a similar plan to your Christmas one and lay low. I love to be alone. I never found the companion that was so companionable as solitude. Henry David Thoreau. Eating alone. So who knew? It's a real thing, the fear of eating alone. And it's got a name, solar mandere phobia. Images of Edward Hopper's Nighthawks flit through my mind. There is no getting around it, no way of disguising it. You are alone, at a table, eating in public. This one took me a long time to master, not days or months, but years. But we solo diners are not as alone as we think. While it may not feel like it, people eating alone represent the fastest growing group of diners. The Australian online booking service Dimi reports that reservations for one are rising exponentially every year. On the positive side, you can usually snag a table for one at even the most popular restaurants. Do your research in advance. Know where the restaurant is and how you're going to get there. Make a reservation and choose a time before or after peak hour. Seats near an open kitchen are a good choice when you're by yourself. I enjoy watching the chefs move around with the grace and syncopation of dancers. This is often easier to arrange at lunch rather than at dinner. In fact, if you're new to this, eating alone at lunchtime is a less daunting prospect altogether. If there is a bar that also serves food, you can usually squeeze in and have a good view of what's going on. Communal tables are always easier, but it is still a good idea to take props with you. I think a phone dilutes the bold statement made by the solo diner, but a book, magazine, or notepad are all acceptable dining companions, and a scarf is useful to save your place if you go to the loo. As eating alone becomes more common, service and attitudes towards single diners are improving. In the meantime, be strong. When it comes to ordering, I Google the menu in advance to see what's on offer. It makes me feel more in control once I'm there. I tend to stay near the top of the menu and choose two starters, served in succession, plus a salad, rather than a starter and a main course, which can often prove too big and expensive. When I'm alone, I try to notice more, eat less. As a bit of a game, deploy all your senses while eating. Look closely at the colours and textures of the food. Close your eyes and see if it tastes different. Eavesdrop on conversations and write a short story in your head about the other diners. The happiest of all lives is a busy solitude, Voltaire. Acceptance of solo diners varies by country. I can't wait to try the world's first restaurant designed for people dining alone, Eenmaal, One Meal, in Amsterdam. It describes itself as the first one-person restaurant in the world, and an attractive place for temporary disconnection. Most people who dine there are not single or living by themselves, but just want time alone. It started as a temporary pop-up, but has been so popular it has become permanent and now plans to expand internationally. Tokyo's Moomin House Cafe takes a different approach to lone patrons, who are automatically seated with a stuffed Moomin hippo-like toy for company. Since the lonely friendly concept went viral, business has boomed. It sounds a trifle desperate to me. I have eaten my way solo across Asia, India, and Europe, Moomin free, no problem. Some restaurateurs find single diners annoying. Their argument goes, we take up a table for two, we don't drink as much, most of their profits come from alcohol, and we don't contribute to the ambience. I wonder what would be their collective noun for solo diners. An irritation, I suspect. I've been asked to move table mid-mouthful to accommodate a group of three and have been shepherded to a table by the loo more times than I care to remember. It's not ideal, and now I don't accept it, and neither should you. There are two ways to avoid it. If you are making a reservation online, there is usually a comments section. Put your request in there. Secondly, become a regular at a couple of local restaurants. I'll never forget a charming scene in the Café La Palette in Paris, when all the waiters were fussing around a charismatic elderly lady, clearly a regular, and her little white dog, who sat next to her at the table and had his own steak. Tourists were battered aside and she was treated like a queen. If you need a confidence boost, adopt an alter ego for the evening. Suzanne the foodie, or Caroline, the out-of-town businesswoman, or just pretend you're writing a restaurant review. Keep a notebook for when you dine out alone and write about your meal as you experience it. Keep the business card and receipt and stick them in a book, or become an expert in one cuisine in your town. A friend has started a Dumplings Over Diamonds Instagram site where she rates different dumpling houses all over Sydney. Solo Cinema. This is a guilty pleasure, although I'm not sure why, as cinemas and theatres are not set up to be social anyway. We are required to sit in silence for 2 hours. Do it with aplomb, taking the opportunity to escape the world, rather than apologetically fiddling with your phone. There is no stigma when you watch cinema's ugly younger sister, television, alone. So why does the thought of being flanked by 2 empty red velvet seats make us feel awkward? You get to pick what you really want to see. And here, among friends, I can confess to a weakness for Star Trek movies. You can eat what you like, don't have to worry about friends talking or checking their phones throughout the film, and you can go any time of day. There is something really decadent about going to the movies when it's light. Again, it is quite nice to keep going back to your local cinema, and you can usually get a good deal by joining their movie club. I am lucky enough to live near an art house cinema, and I'm on their email alert, so I try to catch something arty, foreign, and mind-stretching every few weeks. If you feel awkward buying a ticket for one, book it online. However, I find there are usually plenty of people going alone. Why not keep a movie notebook and critique and rate each film you see? Take tissues if you're prone to crying, as I am. And don't pick a horror film and then go home to an empty house. Unknown in Paris, I was lost in the great city, but the feeling of living there alone, taking care of myself without any aid, did not at all depress me. If sometimes I felt lonesome, my usual state of mind was one of calm and great moral satisfaction. Marie Curie. Part 2. Making the most of your time alone. Martha Beck asked her Facebook followers what was the best gift they could give themselves. The most popular answer by far was time, and more specifically, time alone. So we solos should feel incredibly lucky that we have in abundance precisely what many people crave, time alone. However, we don't always feel lucky, do we? There are days when the clock seems to defy the laws of physics and time flies by. Then there are others when a lifetime passes, but the clock hands have only nudged minutes, and all you can see is the giant maw of time yawning to be filled. I don't like that feeling, so I'll try to tackle it head on here. I'm not talking about work. Living alone, it is all too easy to fall into the trap of regularly working at weekends and in the evenings. You rarely get thanked for it, and after a while, people will come to expect it from you. By all means, work hard and love your job, but working in your own time is not a substitute for living, and your job doesn't hug you back. Instead, use the time to figure out who you are and what you love, and do it. Living a bigger life. Living alone makes you responsible for using your time productively. A clue lies in the first word, living. You wouldn't be reading this if you didn't want to live rather than just exist. That means pushing yourself a little into doing things you might find challenging or uncomfortable. It is harder to make the box of your life bigger than it is to live cozily in a smaller one. I want to push the margins of my life outwards. I get the feeling that some of the most interesting things will happen in that space. The best things in life are often difficult. When something challenges you and forces you to adapt, learning a language, moving cities, trying a new sport, it keeps you on your toes. You know you are alive. It is every man's duty to assume the moral responsibility for his own boredom. Samuel Johnson. Start doing things for and with yourself. Years ago, I saw a Nike poster of a woman running. The slogan was simply, "My time." Now, years later, that captures the way I think about the time I spend alone. My attitude shifts when I think about doing things for myself or with myself rather than by myself. A similar light bulb moment occurred when I first heard the accurate phrase, learning differences, as opposed to learning difficulties. It's not semantics. If you are facing a high grey wall of aloneness, it is a useful, in fact vital, way to reframe your state of being. Don't look sideways. I often had the sneaking feeling that my friends were off doing marvellous things that didn't include me, while I was plodding away doing boring stuff alone, especially on weekends. Maybe they were out on a boat, or trying a new restaurant, or having a picnic on a beach. Of course they weren't. This wasn't fear of missing out, FOMO. I just thought other people had more interesting lives than me, and that was the price I paid for being alone. Quite apart from the fact that comparison is the thief of joy, the reality is that we all have to do the same stuff. Clean the car, go to the supermarket, do the ironing, watch cats playing Jenga on the internet. So keep your eyes forward and think about what you are doing, not what others might be doing. The mixed blessings of technology. I do seriously love you, my laptop, my precious, but I know that too much of you is not good for me. For starters, I am predisposed to indulge in an unholy orgy of Netflix. It is crack cocaine for the need to pass the time part of me, but battery acid for the soul when taken in excess. Someone even went as far as to call box sets a diagnostic tool for depression. I recognize that too much screen time is a time thief. It diminishes me a bit and can make my mood worse. Social media is a double-edged sword, genuinely connecting us, but also shoving other people's smugness in our faces. You might find some online communities genuinely supportive and interesting, but many are ersatz, soaking up time that would be better spent making connections with real people. I also wonder, as this thoughtful piece by William Derezowitz argues, if too much interaction with technology dilutes our own perspective on the world. Thinking for yourself means finding yourself, finding your own reality. Here's the other problem with Facebook and Twitter, and even the New York Times. When you expose yourself to those things, especially in the constant way that people do now, older people as well as younger people, you are continuously bombarding yourself with a stream of other people's thoughts. You are marinating yourself in conventional wisdom, in other people's reality, for others, not for yourself. You are creating a cacophony in which it is impossible to hear your own voice, whether it's yourself you're thinking about or anything else. That's what Emerson meant when he said that he who should inspire and lead his race must be defended from traveling with the souls of other men, from living, breathing, reading, and writing in the daily, time-worn yoke of their opinions. Notice that he uses the word lead. Leadership means finding a new direction, not simply putting yourself at the front of the herd that's heading toward the cliff. I feel ambivalent about taking photos on my phone too. The sublime Adele nailed it when she snapped at a concert goer filming her singing. Could you stop filming me with that video camera? Because I'm really here in real life. You can enjoy it in real life rather than through your camera. This isn't a DVD. This is a real show. I've already mentioned my aversion to taking pictures instead of actually looking at things, and it's the same with taking photos of your food. They just become part of a virtual stamp collection and lessen the responsibility of your taste buds to enjoy the meal. Digital detox holidays are enjoying rapid growth, and I'm not surprised. The Gin Tub, a bar in Hove, England, has enjoyed a surge in popularity since it started blocking mobile phone signals. Mind you, the Gin Tub sounds like fun anyway. Just as we are trying to make our nutritional diet healthier, it's also worth thinking about our digital diet, taking care of what we watch and searching out things we can learn from. The intellect must not be kept at consistent tension, but diverted by pastimes. The mind must have relaxation and will rise stronger and keener after recreation. Seneca. Familiar interests. In the next section, we'll think about new things to do. But first, let's look closer to home at interests you already have. Rather than just turning the topsoil of an existing hobby, how about digging deeper and mining the seams that hold diamonds? Obviously, you can pursue interests as a couple, but being alone gives you the opportunity to fling yourself into them passionately, with abandon and absorption. Dance with your curiosity, flirt with your proclivities. Don't just cast a fishing line, throw in a whole illegal mile-long trawling net. That could mean reading up in detail on a subject, signing up to a course or a series of lectures, or perfecting an existing skill. Rather than tackling a lot of different interests, try to focus deeply on one or two areas, like putting blinkers on a horse. This is also a huge opportunity to develop professionally. You might consider a course that will enhance your current occupation or hone your digital skills or tackle something new if you're considering a switch in careers. Lynda.com has a massive range of online courses that you can browse. Learning is like rowing upstream. Not to advance is to drop back. Chinese proverb. And new inspirations. A mind stretched by a new idea can never shrink back to its original dimensions. Oliver Wendell Holmes. If you feel a bit Groundhog Day-ish and find your daily choreography is being repeated over and over, force yourself to do something new each week. Interested equals interesting. Furnish your mind, said Helen Gurley Brown, the legendary feminist and editor of Cosmopolitan. If we don't push our minds, they stagnate, so shake things up and make new memories along the way. Here are a few ideas. If inspiration doesn't strike, potter about your home and follow the metaphorical trail of breadcrumbs. Little clues will present themselves. Think of this as the prologue to a play. An old book, unfinished craft project, souvenir or photograph might trigger a memory of something you wanted to do but gave up, or inspire you to try something new. The Japanese proverb, Onkei Shishin, study something old to learn something new, captures this idea well. Write a list of all the minor museums in your area and tick them off one by one. Go to an art gallery and allow your gut instinct to choose just two or three paintings to really look at. What are they trying to tell you that is relevant to your life right now? Become a flâneuse. Lauren Elkin describes a flâneuse as a determined, resourceful woman, keenly attuned to the creative potential of the city and the liberating possibilities of a good walk. She has written a book called Flâneuse, Women Walk the City in Paris, New York, Tokyo, Venice, and London, which traces the paths of cross-dressing 19th century novelist George Sand, Parisian artist Sophie Calle, journalist Martha Gellhorn, and writer Jean Rhys. Walk your city with new eyes and map it with your feet. Find yourself a new grassy hillside and enjoy a solo picnic. Paint or draw a self-portrait. Look at some of Frida Kahlo's for inspiration. She said, "I am my own muse. I am the subject I know best, the subject I want to know better." Get to know your neighborhood intimately. Learn its best walks and history. Take photos of old houses before they're knocked down. Try the sport venues, theater, and library. There is often more on offer than you realize. Go to a drop-in dance class or learn a dance routine. YouTube. Fly a kite. Go on an artist's date, as recommended in Julia Cameron's best-selling The Artist's Way. This is a solo expedition to develop your creative self, enchant yourself, and refill your creative inner well so that when you go to fish, there's something swimming there. It could be a trip to an art supply or fabric shop, a garden, art gallery, or cinema. She describes the concept at juliacameron.com. Draw a mandala. Explore your local parks and gulp down some natural wonder. The wonder of the internet is the long tails of people who share niche interests, such as photographing ghost signs, the faded advertising painted on old commercial buildings, find one that captures your interest. Inspire yourself with a TED Talk. Learn to meditate with Headspace. Find a podcast series you love. ABC Radio's Conversations with Richard Feidler is a good place to start. I'm also a sucker for spoken word radio, especially BBC Radio 4 dramas. 15-minute drama, afternoon drama, and book at bedtime are firm favourites. Browse Pinterest and make up some dream boards. Go to meetup.com and find a like-minded group to do things with. Write an outline of your life story. Draw your childhood home, the view from the outside and the layout, making note of any special memories the room spark in you. Do a first aid course. Give blood. Volunteer for a charity. Try govolunteer.com.au. Learn something from the French Whisperer on YouTube. I won't spoil your fun by telling you what to expect. Learn the planets in the solar system. There's an app for it. Learn a poem. Start with the anthology, Poems That Make Grown Women Cry, edited by Anthony and Ben Holden. T.S. Eliot described poetry as writing with a lot of silence on the page. Sometimes to find out where the edge is, you have to put your toes over it, so reach out. Do not be too timid and squeamish about your actions. All life is an experiment. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Read yourself bigger. Proust wrote, "We read to know ourselves," which may explain my renewed pleasure in books. Cassandra Clare said, "One must always be careful of books and what is inside them, for words have the power to change us." "You're never alone with a book," as Niccolò Machiavelli noted 500 years ago. "I strip off my muddy, sweaty, workaday clothes, and I enter the antique courts of the ancients, and for the space of 4 hours I forget the world." Or, as W.H. Auden pointed out, "A real book is not one that we can read, but one that reads us." Certainly, there are not many other activities that offer us the opportunity to go brain to brain with another human being, as we do when reading an author's words. I now read with a highlighter and also note down particular phrases that please me. Consider joining an online book club, such as the BBC World Service World Book Club, which interviews a different author monthly. You can listen to old episodes as podcasts. Check out your local library too. I listen to many more books than I read. At the moment, I'm tackling 6 Jane Austens in audiobook as I yomp across the park. Other audiobooks I've enjoyed include H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, Anything by David Sedaris or Bill Bryson, and a slew of exceptional BBC productions. The Martin Beck Mysteries by Per Wallou and Maj Showell, dramatizations of Dickens and Austen, A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth, recorded in India, and Sherlock Holmes dramatizations. I find myself more and more particular about what I read, happily ditching a book halfway through if I'm not enjoying it. They say there are 2 categories of books that you don't finish, those that aren't good enough, and those for which you are not yet good enough. There are 129 million titles in the world. Better get cracking. Without knowledge, life is no more but the shadow of death. Molière. Self-development. Without wishing to dip a toe into the seductive pool of self-obsession, living alone does offer a unique opportunity to develop as a human being. This whole book is about precisely that, so I'm not going to labour the point, except to say that for years I was embarrassed to be seen in the self-help section of the bookstore. It helped me when they renamed it self-enrichment. After all, you'd be foolish not to want to enrich yourself, wouldn't you? My only note of warning, having been there, seen it, done it, is that it's easy to buy loads of self-help books, flick through them once, put them on your bookshelf and leave them there. More shelf improvement than self-improvement. There's nothing more depressing than a bookcase full of them. Casting judgment because the secret, law of attraction, didn't work for you, because you don't care who moved your cheese, you're not interested in chicken soup for the soul, or because you feel you are the only person in the world who hasn't defined their life purpose. No one book will answer your questions. So flick through them, pick out the best thoughts, write them in your journal, and then give the books away. Creativity is the child of solitude. There are many great achievers who never married and who lived alone, including Isaac Newton, Friedrich Nietzsche, Beatrix Potter, Emily Dickinson, Greta Garbo, and Beethoven. You might find your creativity blossoming during time spent alone, as it did 100 years ago for Australian artist Clarice Beckett. She had a very domineering father, turned down several offers of marriage, had a couple of lovers, but spent most of her time looking after her ill parents. The only time she escaped her duties was when walking the suburbs of Melbourne at dawn and dusk to paint. Her creativity blossomed in solitude. She died aged 47, unknown until her sister walked into a gallery with a parcel of paintings and sketches 40 years later. This led to the discovery of over 2,000 works in an old shed that was open to the elements. Many were damaged beyond repair, but a few have survived. They are beautiful. Her sadness and resilience forged them in solitude. Many people have found Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way helpful for assessing their innate creativity. There is now an online course as well as the original book. I always wince a little when I hear, "We are all creative," but it's true. Often it is squashed out of us when we're children. When I was about 7, I wrote a poem about my bedroom. I took care writing it and remember being quite pleased with it, but the teacher gave me a D because she refused to believe I had written it myself. As a consequence, I never wrote another poem. Until last month. I have no doubt I would not have written it were I not living alone. Success is the best form of revenge, so stick 2 fingers up to the doubters and show them what you can do. Don't just uncover your creativity, unleash it. Creativity can be applied to many aspects of life. Cooking, how you dress, how you decorate your house. I enjoy arty crafty stuff. I don't have the luxury of enough space to keep brushes and paints out all the time, so I have a different canvas bag for each of my projects. Chinese brush paintings of fish, watercolours, an altered book and some embroidery on toile inspired by textile artist Richard Sager are my current projects. I like having a bag to dip into for an hour or two. Living alone, I am an island, but an interesting island, full of exciting places to explore. Embrace boredom. My generation was the last to fully experience boredom. Technology now fills the spaces between the stones. Years ago, I went to see the highlights of the Bolshoi Ballet. I was very much looking forward to it, but it turned out to be one of the most boring shows I had ever seen, because the highlights, big jumps twirling around and around 1,000 times, lose their power and wonder without the calm, slow parts as contrast. Boredom is no bad thing if it means you can be quiet and listen. Boredom and breakthrough can be twins. However, if it really gets to you, make yourself an anti-boredom kit. Write down suggestions for things to do on slips of paper and put them in a box. They might be practical, tidy out 3 drawers, clean the fridge, or more creative, learn a poem, call 2 friends, send a real handwritten letter to a friend you've lost contact with. Dip into your ideas box if you're ever hit by the boredom stick. Boredom transforms into something else. Boredom is the uncomfortable bit, and then what you break through to is reverie, those higher planes of creative thought. Michael Harris, The End of Absence. Give yourself a break. Literally and metaphorically, not every day has to be high achieving. I am tired of feeling I need to be capable all the time. It is important to recharge your batteries and refill the well. Give yourself permission to disengage completely now and again. Take a day or evening off and chill out to the max. Make yourself something comforting to eat. My choice is usually Nigel Slater's shepherd's pie. Pour a glass of good red wine and watch a movie, perhaps with some pieces of the bitterest, darkest, most expensive chocolate you can lay your hands on. And don't forget the words of the immortal Willy Wonka. A little nonsense now and then is relished by the wisest men. Takeaways. Don't ever be intimidated by doing something alone. The more you challenge yourself, the more confident you will become, standing up to the curiosity and pity of friends and family. You are an armadillo. When traveling, don't look, see. Don't hear, listen. Don't learn, understand. Plan your next solo trip now. Plan strategies for Christmas, eating alone, and lovely solo cinema excursions. Do things with or for yourself, not by yourself. Plan your digital interactions. Do familiar things more deeply, or push yourself to try new things. Just do something. The poet Wallace Stevens called it stepping across the line. Embrace boredom and give yourself a break. If your ship hasn't come in, swim out to it. Chapter 9. Solo Spirituality. Why it is important, what you are looking for, and how to incorporate it into your life. Facing up to grief and death. Spirituality is an intensely personal and complex subject, not just another item to tick off the self-development checklist. I'm a pragmatist, and have already told you about my sensitive bullshit antenna, so it shouldn't come as a surprise that I find much of what has been written about spirituality and religion incomprehensible and confusing. I want to make this subject inspirational and practical for you. Simply, how do you go about finding what works for you and applying it to your life? Before we set out on this journey of discovery, we need to define what we're looking for. Three questions. Why is spirituality important? What do I do to find what I'm looking for? How do I incorporate it into everyday life? Why? Why is it important to have spirituality in your life? What role does it play? You have to be very strong to live alone, and having an internal life reinforces you, inside and out. Spirituality has two sides, like Janus, the god with two faces. One side is a well, an internal reservoir of courage and wisdom you can draw on. The other side informs and feeds your energy, and the way you project yourself to the world. Once you have found equilibrium between them, you will also be in a much stronger position to help others. When I asked solo women what prompts them to look deeper, this is what they said. I want to explore a different part of my life. It's not my work or friends, or my home or day-to-day life. It's a separate part of me. It's very personal. I feel there is a whole part of myself that is unexplored. More being, less doing. I want to understand myself better. I want to uncover my authentic self. I feel hollow inside. I want to give back. I recently got divorced. I am desperately sad and need to get some perspective. I want some peace. Untangle the ball of wool that is my life and make it simpler. I want to believe in something other than myself. I feel disconnected from myself. My mother's death has made me rethink everything. I want to calm my monkey mind. I feel I'm just beginning to wake up. I feel incomplete. It's part of my transformation. I want to find a way to integrate something spiritual into my day-to-day life. I don't feel religious, but feel there is something bigger than me. I see an energy in some of my friends that I would like to have too. I'm scared of dying. I just want to learn to meditate. I feel a sort of spiritual itch that needs to be scratched. I want to unearth my purpose. Our advantage. Identifying what spirituality means to us individually, what works, and how to incorporate it into our lives requires time and space. Fortunately, we soloists are rich in both commodities. This is where we have a distinct advantage, and we owe it to ourselves to make the most of it, to explore this part of our lives. Solitude makes it easier to connect to the spiritual self, to explore and maintain a connection with the inner world. Your spirituality will unfurl. What? This is an adventure of the soul, so rather than pushing yourself to do, relax, explore a few different things and see what resonates. Sometimes it takes a while to recognize the path that is right for you, and initially it can be confronting. You might not like what you see when, sometimes for the first time in a while, you step back and look within. We don't usually tackle these big questions because they're fun or have easy answers. They can bring us to our knees. This is a journey for the brave. The most frequent impediment to men's turning the mind inwards upon themselves is that they are afraid of what they shall find there. There is an aching hollowness in the bosom, a dark, cold speck at the heart, an obscure and boding sense of somewhat that must be kept out of sight of the conscience, some secret lodger whom they can neither resolve to eject or retain. Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So you are not alone in being apprehensive. Don't let it daunt you. Think of it as the foxing on an old mirror falling away to reveal a clear reflection. The benefits of solitude. History offers up many examples of men and women who have used solitude to their advantage to better understand themselves and access a higher power. I'm not advocating whipping off to a cave for 40 days and 40 nights, but we can maybe take a small leaf out of their book. A favourite of mine is Saint Jerome, who spent time alone in the desert, along the way removing a thorn from the paw of a passing lion. The lion followed him around like a dog for the rest of his life. I particularly love the painting of Jerome by Antonello da Messina in the National Gallery in London. He is depicted reading in his study, which is set in a beautiful architectural space. I love the atmosphere of concentration and self-containment it exudes, not to mention the beautifully observed details, such as a cat curled at his feet, the towel draped on a hook, and his lion in the shadows. Jerome is utterly self-possessed and alone. The joy of silence. As time passes, I increasingly realize that there is an interior dimension to silence, a sort of stillness of the heart and mind, which is not a void, but a rich space, wrote Sarah Maitland in her excellent A Book of Silence. She rented a small, isolated cottage on the Isle of Skye and waited and listened to the silence. She discovered much more than she expected, including physical changes, such as an intensifying of her senses of taste and hearing, her sense of body temperature becoming more acute, and a concentration of emotions, joy, sadness, and giggles. She became disinhibited, only washing once a week but relishing her hot bath. No need to conform to society's norms. She tells of many other people who had similar experiences. And it was not just from being isolated and alone. She felt that the silence itself unskinned her. The American composer John Cage wrote 4 minutes 33 seconds of silence. It is a 3-movement piece in which the musicians were not allowed to play their instruments. The silence was filled with the ambient sounds the audience could hear, and these became the piece itself. You can see a performance on YouTube. It's amazing what you can hear in silence. Try to weave some silence into the fabric of each day. Dawn is a good place to start. I find myself getting up earlier and earlier and love this time of day. It feels as if it's a secret I have to myself. Anthony Robbins calls this the hour of power, and Hal Elrod made a thing out of it with his book Miracle Morning, which is worth a look. And you, when will you begin that long journey into yourself, Rumi? Listen to your intuition. Always trust your instincts is something I believe so strongly that I had it printed at the bottom of every page of my book, Midlife Manifesto. But maybe it is intuition, rather than instincts, that we should pay attention to. What's the difference between the two? You don't have a conscious choice about instinct. It is hardwired and will cause you to respond in a certain way, whether you like it or not. The knowledge is set in the hollow of your bones, like raising your hands if someone is about to hit you, or jumping at a loud noise. Intuition is more of a feeling or a hunch that makes one way of reacting more attractive than another, but you are still free to choose whether to follow it or not. It is informed by your experiences. The quieter you are, the louder the voice of intuition, your spiritual GPS. Listen to it, and it will lead you towards a spiritual perspective and practice that's right for you. As Lisa Kogan said, yes, spiritual enlightenment as sandals are good, but so are air conditioning and indoor plumbing. You can find spiritual enlightenment wherever you are, whenever you're ready. Make your own rules. We forget that the world's greatest spiritual leaders were the firebrands and radicals of their day, exhorting their followers not to accept blindly what had gone before. By making an effort to understand and question the past and find the parts that resonate, we are honoring the path laid out by those great minds. They challenged aspects of dogma that might have been relevant centuries earlier. Even Buddha on his deathbed told his disciples, "Do not accept what you hear by report. Do not accept tradition. Do not accept a statement because it is found in our books, nor because it is in accord with your belief, nor because it is the saying of your teacher. Be lamps unto yourselves." We all want to experience what the American mythologist Joseph Campbell called the rapture of being alive. There is no one path. Each of us is a sentient being with our own mind. What is right for me might not be right for you. Religions are like cookbooks and guidebooks. They are not the food or the foreign country. Rather, they suggest ingredients and point us in the right direction, writes Elizabeth Lesser in The Seeker's Guide, which I highly recommend. You are the only one who can plot your journey. Start with an open mind. By the time you reach the point in your life where you are curious about exploring spirituality, you might have acquired a few rusted-on opinions, like barnacles on a whale. These could include your existing religious or spiritual beliefs, or those of your parents or friends. While that is not necessarily a bad thing, it's always worth taking a step back to look with fresh eyes. I am fortunate to live in a part of the world and in an era when questioning accepted wisdom and even the existence of God does not result in being ducked in the village pond. We are free to consider all sides of the debate. It is fascinating when you hear someone as articulate as Stephen Fry putting forward a very compelling anti-God argument. Have a look at the YouTube interview, Stephen Fry on God, the Meaning of Life. He doesn't pull any punches. For example, when asked what he'd say to God at the pearly gates, he replied, "Bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world where there is such misery that's not our fault? It's not right. It is utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain?" My father would have agreed with him. He lost his faith after the Second World War, when he simply could not reconcile a God who let 6 million of his chosen people die in the Holocaust. There is no doubt that organized religion can offer those who live by themselves spiritual sustenance, as well as a good way to connect with other like-minded people and belonging to a tribe or congregation. There are so many different faiths and practices, it is worth learning more if you're curious. Consider doing a short course on comparative religion and even attend different religious services, obviously asking respectful permission when necessary. I have been to services in a mosque, a synagogue, and a Russian Orthodox church, but found a Quaker meeting the most moving. Sometimes attending a service from a different faith can act as a circuit breaker, making you question your preconceptions and beliefs, and helping refine your individual approach to spirituality.